Today is Wednesday, March 29th. We're going to start with more nervous system information, brain and spinal cord. Okay, so we're on page 104. We're going to look at spinal cord and spinal nerves. So first of all, let's start off by talking about the difference between the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. What are the organs you find in your central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. Good. They're, of course, the central control. They're the command center for the body. And the peripheral nervous system includes what? Good. Spinal nerves and cranial nerves. Good. So in terms of protection, the skull protects the brain. What protects the spinal cord? Vertebrae. Yep. So that spinal cord runs inside the intervertebral foramen of the vertebrae. And that, of course, is a safe place to house that spinal cord. So we're going to focus first on the spinal cord, and we're going to talk about how it's set up, and then we're going to tie it in with those spinal nerves that branch off your spinal cord. All right, so spinal cord structure is around 18 inches long. It emerges from the base of your brain at the foramen magnum, and it travels down to around your vertebrae, L1 or L2. Thinking about your body, L1 is a lumbar vertebrae. So where are they found?
Lower back,
right. So about where your waist is, right above your buttocks, that area is where we find L1 or L2. And at that point, we now see the spinal cord taper off and end. You'll notice the tapered ending here is called the conus medullaris. And the word cone is in there. Conus medullaris is cone-shaped, kind of like an ice cream cone. We no longer have a spinal cord. What we have instead are branched spinal nerves that come off and flare down through our sacrum and coccyx like a horse's tail. And that's why we have this terminal portion here called the cauda equina. Technically, it is a horse's tail. So we have all of these spinal nerves branching off here at the end. So there's technically no way to get a spinal cord injury below vertebrae L1 or L2. However, you can injure those spinal nerves that branch off. So since the spinal cord terminates around L1 or L2, that's the last portion of it that can be injured. There is a little sheath or covering on the spinal cord. You'll notice a term there called filum terminale. And that's a bit of fibrous connective tissue that acts as a guard or a covering over that conus medullaris at the end. So that's kind of a protective sheath that's down there at the termination point for your spinal cord. So speaking of coverings, I'd like to introduce three layers of membranes. They're called meninges. These meninges cover both brain and spinal cord. Now, from the outermost membrane, we have something called the dura mater. Dura means tough. Mater means mother. So this is technically the tough mother that covers the outermost portion of your brain and spinal cord. Now, if you're thinking in terms of a tough layer, I would think of something kind of like wax paper, you know, a pretty tough covering. It's not transparent. And in fact, this dura mater is anchored to the inside of your skull for your brain, and it's anchored to the inside of the vertebrae, that vertebral foramen opening for your spinal cord. So the dura mater is the outermost covering for your brain and spinal cord. Underneath the dura mater is a web-like layer, and so they've named it the arachnoid matter. What circulates through the arachnoid layer? Cerebrospinal fluid, good. So that circulates around your brain in the arachnoid layer and also around your spinal cord in that arachnoid layer. Finally, the deepest of our layers is called the pia mater, and pia means soft mother. So you've got the tough mother on the outside, the spider web-like layer in between, and you've got the soft mother on the innermost layer. So pia mater is like shrink wrap. It directly covers and adheres to your spinal cord or your brain. So that is the layer that comes in direct contact with your central nervous system. Y'all know what shrink wrap is, right? Okay. So it's, I've mentioned it before, and people have to ask, you know, what is shrink wrap? But if you buy a product that has plastic covering on it and you have to peel it off, it's really tightly adhered, that's shrink wrap. All right, so from superficial to deep, can you tell me the layers of the matter covering the brain and spinal cord? So from superficial, you've got dura, arachnoid, and then pia mater. Good. So DAP is a way to remember it. Dura, arachnoid, and then pia mater. I just wanted to mention, kind of as a side note, that if people have lumbar taps performed, the lumbar tap is involving a needle placed into that arachnoid layer around the outside of the spinal cord. And it allows us to aspirate out fluid. And we're looking for perhaps bacteria, viruses, or even fungi that are circulating in that arachnoid layer. So if somebody has, say, horrific headaches and they suspect spinal meningitis, then they may do a lumbar tap to check for bacteria or viruses in that circulating cerebrospinal fluid. I had a student several years ago in Bio 211, and her husband was a line worker for one of these like power companies. And they lived out in Marion, so he was the one climbing the poles and working on the power cables up at the top of the poles. Well, what they suspect is, you know, birds like to sit up there, and birds do what birds do, which is poop. And that they think that perhaps he inhaled fungi off of the bird poop. It got into his sinuses and then got into his cerebrospinal fluid, and it caused all sorts of problems, and he fought for a year to get rid of this kind of fungal meningitis. So he had blood clots on the brain. They had him in and out of the hospital, and he finally got rid of the infection. And guess what? He went back to work doing what he'd been doing before. So, yeah, I mean, it's a rare thing for something like that to happen, but if something gets into the spinal cord region or the brain region, it becomes very difficult to treat. Likewise, a epidural is kind of the same concept. Instead of aspirating fluid out to sample it, what are we doing this time? Putting it in. Yeah, so this time we're putting medication in. So an epidural is meant to provide some type of a block, and so that should block feeling from some point below on the spinal cord. But the same concept is involved. Inject a needle into the space around the outside of the spinal cord, and that way you're not hitting the spinal cord itself. So let's talk about spinal nerves about halfway down your page. There are how many pairs of spinal nerves? 31 pairs. That's a good number to know. You may have heard the breakfast, lunch, and dinner joke associated with the vertebrae. Okay, so like 7, 12, and 5. Okay, so y'all are nodding, so I'm assuming you heard about that. Okay, so there's 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, 5 lumbar vertebrae. They correspond to the times you eat. But notice the little change here. On your sheet, there are actually 8 cervical spinal nerves. There are 7 vertebrae, but there are 8 cervical spinal nerves. Same from this point, though. There's 12 thoracic spinal nerves. There's 5 lumbar spinal nerves. 5 sacral, and 1 coccygeal. Okay. So I'd like to tell you about this naming scheme for the spinal nerves. Normally, the spinal nerves are associated with the vertebrae. So that makes sense that you're going to find, you know, thoracic spinal nerves near the thoracic vertebrae. So we expect that naming scheme. But it's a little odd because there's an extra pair of spinal nerves, and they emerge above the first cervical vertebrae. So when you're looking at these are all vertebrae. We're starting here with atlas, which is C1, and there's a pair of spinal nerves that emerge above, and they're called the C1 spinal nerves. So for the cervical vertebrae, the spinal nerves emerge above the vertebrae. So if you're looking at atlas, the pair of spinal nerves sitting above atlas are in fact C1 spinal nerves. This trend works all the way down until you get to C7 and C8. C7 spinal nerves do sit above C7 vertebrae. But then the next one is C8. You'll notice what it sits above, though. It sits above our first thoracic vertebrae. So it's like, we counted wrong. We don't know what to do here. So just put the eighth one in there. We'll just keep on going. So you'll notice that the thoracic vertebrae sits above the spinal nerve for which it is named. Okay? So let me repeat this, because in the cervical region, the spinal nerves emerge above the vertebrae for which they're named. Above. And starting with your thoracic vertebrae, the spinal nerves sit below, okay? So cervical spinal nerves are above the vertebrae for which they're named. Starting at T1 all the way to the bottom, spinal nerves emerge below the vertebrae for which they're named. Cervical spinal nerves emerge above the vertebrae for which they're named. Starting at T1 vertebrae, your spinal nerves now emerge below the vertebrae for which they are named. Y'all have questions so far? So let me clarify here. The spinal cord is the central nervous system. These nerves that poke through, these intervertebral foramen, they're part of our peripheral nervous system. So when you hear the word nerve, that automatically makes me think of the peripheral nervous system. We don't have nerves, so to speak, in our central nervous system. We call them something else. We call them tracts when they're in our central nervous system. So in this picture, the spinal cord itself is CNS, and those spinal nerves are PNS. So what I'd like to do is flip you over and look at a picture, but we're going to fill the information in on the picture at the same time we cover the bottom of this page. There is a picture on the bottom of page 105 that we're going to talk about, and you're going to need the bottom of 104, though, to cover that picture.
You said the spinal cord was CNS and the spinal nerve was PNS.
PNS, that's right. Okay, so we're going to ignore the spinal cord for just a moment. We're going to focus on these spinal nerves that are coming off the spinal cord. These spinal nerves are considered to be mixed nerves. What that means is if a nerve is mixed, it has both sensory and motor neurons traveling inside of it. So, you know, roads like the one out front here are two-way. You can go either direction on this road, and that's kind of like what a mixed nerve is. In what direction do the sensory neurons carry information in the spinal nerve?
Towards the
spinal cord and toward the brain, right? And in what direction do the motor neurons carry information?
Away
from, good. So inside this wrapping right here, you've got those sensory and motor neurons, and they're taking information in opposite directions. There are some nerves in your body, like the ones around your head, those cranial nerves, that are only going to carry information in one direction only. And in that case, we'll say they're sensory only, or we'll say they're motor only. But all 31 pairs of our spinal nerves are mixed nerves, meaning they carry both sensory and motor neurons inside of them. So let's talk about the parts of the spinal nerves and how they correlate with the spinal cord. At the bottom of your page there, 104, you'll notice something called a dorsal root and a dorsal root ganglion. First of all, where is dorsal? The backside, good. Dorsal is another name for posterior in humans. So one great thing to look for is the dorsal root ganglion because it's a bulb-shaped structure. So that's what I look for to determine front from back. That piece right there is our dorsal root ganglion, and now I know I've got the back or posterior side of my spinal root and my spinal cord. So this dorsal root ganglion houses cell bodies. That's what those little pieces sticking up there are. These are cell bodies for neurons that are carrying information into the spinal cord. Okay, so does the dorsal root carry sensory or motor information? Sensory, good. So the dorsal root carries sensory information. Okay, so the dorsal root ganglion is a collection of cell bodies. And these are cell bodies for sensory neurons. Those sensory neurons are carrying information into your spinal cord for processing. The next part on your sheet talks about ventral roots. Ventral is another name for what? For front, good. So ventral, anterior, front, all mean the same thing. So I obviously look for my dorsal root ganglion on the backside, and I know that this piece coming off here is the ventral root. What type of information is carried here? Motor, good. Now, are we going toward the spinal cord or away from? Away from, good. So what you may notice is these roots are actually one-way streets. You've got the sensory root that is taking information only to your spinal cord. This ventral root here takes information away from your spinal cord. But you'll notice that right here they join, and at this point we now have what's called a spinal nerve, and it serves what we expect. It is a mixed nerve, meaning it carries both sensory and motor information. So it's like having one-way streets for just a very short time, and then boom, they become a two-way street right here. Okay, are you so far so good? Do you have any questions so far? Okay, so I should mention to you that those ventral roots carry both somatic information and autonomic information. In fact, both roots do carry these types of information. Let me clarify the difference between them. Somatic information is abbreviated as SNS, and you'll notice that autonomic information is abbreviated as ANS. If you're talking about somatic information, you're talking about information that's voluntarily transmitted to your skeletal muscles. Okay, so some of these motor neurons going out may include somatic, which means we're going to a skeletal muscle telling it to consciously move. However, some of these neurons going out may be autonomic, which means they're involuntarily controlled. So what might the destination be for some of those?
Heart,
smooth muscle, yeah, lungs, things that you can't voluntarily think about and control. So within that motor pathway out, we are carrying both autonomic or automatic information and voluntary skeletal muscle control information. Likewise, in the sensory route, you're also bringing in conscious perception of what's going on and also subconscious or unconscious perception. So we're looking at somatic and autonomic being housed in both routes. Now that we've covered that part of the spinal nerve, let's go and focus on the spinal cord. That's what we find here on the top of page 105. First of all, can you tell me the difference between white matter and gray matter? Good. White is myelinated, gray is not. And so a myelin sheath is formed in the central nervous system by a specific type of cell. This is digging back in the last test info. Yeah, that's it. Oligodendrocytes. So oligodendrocytes form the myelin on our white matter in our central nervous system. And of course, gray matter has no myelin sheaths. Which one of those conducts nerve impulses more quickly?
White
matter, good. Okay, so you'll notice in this picture the gray matter is inside of your spinal cord. This gray matter, some people describe as looking like a butterfly or an H. And they've actually got it pre-labeled for us for the most part, but we're going to go through each of the parts there. Again, we have to be able to orient back from front. So what landmark do you use to determine dorsal side from ventral side? Good. Look for that dorsal root ganglion. That bump is always on the back or posterior side. That tells me that this is my posterior side here, and this is my anterior side down below. And of course, the alternate name for posterior is dorsal. And what about for anterior?
Ventral.
Good. All right, so there are three horns, which are protrusions of your gray matter. They're found inside the spinal cord. You'll notice there's a dorsal, there's a lateral, and a ventral. Alternately, you can call them anterior instead of ventral, or posterior instead of dorsal. It's your choice there. So let's start with the anterior or ventral horn first. You'll notice that this particular portion of your gray matter contains cell bodies of your SNS motor neurons. Boy, in plain English, what does SNS stand for? Somatic nervous system, good. And is that the... That's the voluntary, good. So that is the voluntary control for your motor neurons. And so we're talking about skeletal muscle control. So notice those lateral horns are also going to be home to a type of motor neuron, but this is not voluntary control. This is automatic control. ANS stands for autonomic nervous system. And these are actually sympathetic neurons. We'll talk more about what sympathetic means later on. So these particular motor neurons control involuntary events. Okay, And so the ventral horn is down below. It's a piece that says SM on your worksheet picture. The lateral horn is here on the side. It says VM on your worksheet picture, which means visceral motor. And this top piece here that says SS, that one is actually your posterior or dorsal horn, and that contains interneurons. VS is actually visceral sensory, and SS is technically somatic sensory, and that's where that information comes into the gray matter. VM's visceral motor, so that's autonomic motor. And that one is your lateral horn, and that controls involuntary stuff going out. VS is visceral sensory. That means you've got information, sensory in nature, coming from your organs that you can't consciously think about. You don't consciously perceive that. Let me walk you through some examples so this starts to make some sense. So if you've ever cooked and put your hand on a hot stove, you know that you can reflex back off that hot stove without even thinking about it. And before you realize it, you've jerked your arm away, and then you look and you say, oh, I've just burned my hand. And so it sets in after the fact of what you've just done. So let's say that you've got your hand laying on a hot stove. That information is going to come by way of the spinal nerve. Is it going to go the sensory route or the motor route? Sensory, good. Is that the dorsal root or the ventral root?
Dorsal.
Come the dorsal root. So here comes that information that you put your hand on the hot stove. We're going to check in with this horn here, known as what?
Posterior
horn, right. What is housed in the posterior horn?
Interneurons.
And the interneurons say, ouch, you know, you just burned your hand, okay? And your interneurons say what you should do about it is move your hand away from the source of burn. So the interneurons come down here to either the lateral or this ventral horn. And of course, they tell you to involuntarily reflex your hand off that hot stove. So since it's an involuntary reflex, which of these two horns do you think we come through?
VM.
Yeah, VM. Yeah, that's that lateral horn. And so since it's an involuntary reflex, you are told by this involuntary horn here, this information comes back out your motor route, rejoins your spinal nerve, and when the nerve impulse gets to your arm, what do you do?
Pull it away.
Pull it away. Yep, so you withdraw from that painful stimulus. And that is all done without your conscious control, okay? Have you ever burned your hand and done that, and then you look and you say, oh, God, that's going to hurt, and a second later the pain hits, okay? So that reflex is involuntary, and it's going to pull you away so quick that you prevent further damage. Do you know why it takes a moment for you to actually feel the pain? It didn't go to your brain, right. So here's what has to happen. In order for you to feel that pain, we're going to have to travel across this bridge right here. You know what that bridge is called? Gray commissure. That's it, gray commissure. So that bridge has a hole in it. That hole is the central canal. Do you know what travels through that hole?
Nerves.
Fluid. Yeah, that is a fluid hole. That's where cerebrospinal fluid circulates through. But that little bridge of gray matter is called your gray commissure. So let's do our reflex one more time. If you put your hand on a hot stove, that information comes in your spinal nerve. It splits and travels the sensory route, which is known as our dorsal route, and it comes in here and talks to our interneurons. Those interneurons are in which horns? Dorsal. Yeah. Those interneurons say, oh, I know what to do for this problem, reflex the hand away from the source of pain, and that, of course, is going to come down to one of our two horns here. Since reflexes are involuntary, we're going to use that visceral motor lateral horn, and that one says, hey, move. So we come back out our motor route, and our motor route goes, of course, to our muscles, and our muscles then reflexively contract and move. So there is a delay in getting this pain to the brain because we now take a separate pathway. That pathway is going to involve us going across the gray commissure and then hitting the columns in the white matter. So I'm going to erase this, but I want to make sure everybody's had a chance to copy it or take a picture. I may be able to hit the lights and get the glare to go away. Does that help make it worse? Anybody else need a picture? Okay. So next thing on your sheet is called the white matter, and the white matter surrounds the gray matter within our spinal cord. The white matter is not composed of horns, but rather of columns. And so when you think about white columns, I have this mental image of columns that run the length of your spinal cord, and that's exactly what they do. These are neurons that travel like elevators up and down your spinal cord. They carry sensory information up to your brain, and the motor ones carry information from your brain down the spinal cord. So think of your white matter like elevators. Those elevators are called columns, and they take information either to your brain as sensory info or from your brain as motor info. So we're going to look at some called ascending tracts and descending tracts. Just think of these like elevators. Where would the ascending tracts take you, up or down? Take you up, right? And of course, the descending tract is going to take you down. So you'll notice there that the ascending tracts carry information to your brain. And there's two specific types, spinothalamic and spinocerebellar. I know you just said what. Okay, so ascending tracts are going to be taking information to your brain. And information is classified typically in two ways. Pain and temperature takes one elevator ride up, and joint and muscle information takes a separate elevator ride up. Okay, and so if you're talking about pain and temperature information, we're going to travel over what's called a spinothalamic pathway. So let me show you what the thalamus is. This piece here in red in the center of your brain is the thalamus, and that is kind of like a relay center for incoming information. It is a switchboard. So when pain and temperature come up to the thalamus says, I know where to send that. You burned your hand on a hot stove, so it's going to send that to the part of your brain that codes for your hand. And so you'll feel the pain coming from that burn on the stove. So if we're talking about a pain or a temperature pathway, we're going to follow a path in your spinal cord called the spinothalamic pathway, and our destination is the thalamus in the brain. And the thalamus relays that information out to the appropriate part of your brain to interpret the pain or temperature. Okay, so let's look at this picture here. You'll notice the spinothalamic pathway here, or in general, the sensory pathways, are colored blue. So back here at the back, you've got some blue. On the sides, you've got some blue. So we typically say the dorsal columns and the lateral columns carry pain and temperature information up. Let's go back to your picture. Okay, so here is what we call a dorsal column. And on each side we have what's called a lateral column. And those lateral and dorsal columns carry sensory information up to your brain. Since they're carrying sensory information, should they be called ascending or descending tracts? Ascending, good. Okay, so let's do our reflex again. We've put our hand on a hot stove. We just jerked our hand away. You could do the same thing by stubbing your toe, and you know when you hit it, you think, oh, I just hurt myself really bad, and you have that split second delay before you actually feel the pain. Well, what's happened is the sensory information has to come across the gray commissure. It hops to the opposite side of your spinal cord, and then now it's going to travel in the appropriate track up to your brain. And that may take a split second to get to your brain. It has to go through your thalamus for processing. Let's look at that thalamus again. And of course, the thalamus says, oh, you're talking about your hand or your toe. Let me send that to the appropriate part of your brain. And then finally, you've got that, oh, ouch feeling from having hurt yourself. So that's why there's a split second delay there with information being perceived by your brain. So ascending tracts are either spinothalamic in nature. And what do spinothalamic pathways carry?
Pain and temperature.
Pain and temperature. Or they are spinocerebellar in nature, which means they carry what type of info?
Joint
and muscles. Good. So let's talk about that spinocerebellar pathway. The cerebellum is a piece at the back of your brain. This piece back here is important for maintaining balance. So if you close your eyes and walk in the dark, you can probably manage through your bedroom or through your house with no problem because you're relying on your brain's input of where your body is in space. So you know where your arms and your legs are, your joints and your muscles. All of that info is carried here to your cerebellum at the back of your brain. Okay? So this cerebellum is kind of like a balance or a coordination center, and it receives input from proprioceptors that are situated in your muscles and your joints. What does being drunk do to those proprioceptors? Or your cerebellum?
Throws it off.
Throws it off, yep. So no longer are we as coordinated as we are when we're sober. So, of course, alcohol and things of that sort, even medications can make us somewhat, you know, unbalanced. So that means that cerebellum's not able to coordinate as it should. Let's talk about the descending tracts. Once your brain makes a decision, let's go back to burning our hand. Once your brain says, oh, wow, that really hurts, I burned my hand like heck, maybe you decide to put your hand under some cold water. So now the information comes down your spinal cord in a set of descending tracts. Let me take you back to your picture one more time. We'll label that on here. These descending tracts are found here in this ventral column of the white matter. Okay, descending tracts carry motor information down your spinal cord. The destination is to go to some set of muscles, whether it's voluntary or involuntarily controlled. It'll be a multiple choice setup, yeah, but there'll be a picture similar to this for y'all to label. Do you need a clean copy perhaps to label? I can get you one for Monday. Okay. That's a tiny picture, not a lot of room on there. Okay, so let's hit it from the top. If you burn your hand, that information comes in through sensory roots. That's the dorsal root back here on the back side of the spinal nerve. It hits interneurons, and the interneurons will send an impulse right back out the motor pathway, and they'll also send an impulse across the gray commissure. If we're talking pain and temperature in nature, we hit the appropriate ascending tract It's either in the lateral or the dorsal column. Those are where the majority of our ascending tracts are. Ascending tracts carry information where?
Towards the brain.
Yep, it's sensory in nature, and of course the brain is going to route that information. Since it's pain and temperature, should we go to the thalamus or the cerebellum?
Thalamus,
right. So the thalamus is a switchboard. It relays this information to the correct part of your brain. If you burned your left hand, which side of your brain is it going to? The right side, yeah. So it's actually contralateral controlled, meaning one side of your body is controlled by the opposite side of your brain. Your brain makes a decision on how to handle this, sends the information back down your spinal cord, and this time we travel in a set of descending tracts. Most of those are housed in your ventral column of white matter. And so when we come back down, we'll eventually go across the gray commissure once again, and we'll head out that motor route. But you know, that takes time to relay information up to your brain, back down your spinal cord. So that's why there's a split second delay in your motor response to this problem. Do the parts make sense? The gray matter versus the white matter? How about the roots? Any questions on these? Haven't lost you anywhere, have I?
Is the ventral column the skinny?
It is, yeah. This little piece right in here that's white. And so I've written gray commissure, unfortunately, over the top of it, but it's right in this area right there. Actually, that's the only ventral. That is all lateral. That is all lateral. And that piece back there is all dorsal.
So dorsal, ventral,
both laterals, yeah. Okay, so I'd like to talk to you about phantom limb pain and referred pain. Anybody need a picture? I'm going to put the screen down. Let's see if that helps any. So this is a really cool treatment for phantom limb pain. You know, amputations are necessary for many reasons, and when people have a body part amputated, they may still have sensations in that body part, which you think, you know, gosh, how do they feel something when there's nothing there? Well, it's not necessarily that there's a sensation generated from that missing body part, but the sensation is generated in the spinal cord. So the spinal cord is wired for limbs, whether or not you've got them. Even if you were never born with limbs, you are still wired as if you had them. So interesting thing that your spinal cord may generate sensations, and those sensations travel to your brain. So, you know, kind of a weird thing that your spinal cord kind of takes control and says, hey, I think your leg is itching, but there may in fact not be a leg to itch. This low-tech solution involves placing the patient in front of a mirror. Notice they've covered up his good leg, the one that's present, so he can't necessarily see it. Sure, he's looking at it right now, but when they start the therapy with him, they're going to have him look in this mirror right here at this leg. And after weeks of doing this, there are neurons in the brain that will hopefully start to recognize that there is nothing to come from that limb, and hopefully will start to squelch those nerve impulses, filter those nerve impulses that come. This apparently works for a number of patients. It seems to be an effective way to train the brain to recognize that there is no use telling me about that phantom limb that no longer exists. A lot of phantom limb patients have itches that they can't satisfy, and so this tends to be about the only solution that works to get those neurons to kind of rethink how they're getting information from those phantom limbs. So this is called referred pain, and it's a little different, but you know, you've often heard about heart attack symptoms, right? Besides chest pain, what do we often hear for heart attack symptoms?
Left arm.
Left arm, right. And of course, the heart is not in the left arm, it's in the middle of your chest, so why in the world do people feel pain in their left arm? It's referred pain, and what it is, it's crisscrossing nerves, And that information kind of gets confused as it goes to the brain. And so our perception is that we feel pain in areas where there, in fact, is no pain. So referred pain makes you think there's pain in a certain area when, in fact, there's not. Notice this shading area down here is all for kidney pain. You know where your kidneys sit? Yeah, lower back. So they're in your lower back, but why do people feel pain in their thighs? It's referred pain. So it's a crisscrossing of the way these neurons work. You know, sometimes signals get misinterpreted, and so the brain thinks that there's pain in these areas when in fact there is not. But nonetheless, that's how we interpret pain coming from certain organs. Notice even gallbladder pain. The gallbladder sits actually here up under the right ribs, and we feel gallbladder pain here and up here on the right shoulder, which is crazy. Nobody's gallbladder is on the right shoulder. So again, it's those ascending tracts that carry information up, and the information may not be perceived correctly because of the way the nerves crisscross as they travel into the spinal cord and then up the brain. Okay, so how about questions on this page? This is 105. I think you all are probably up to speed with epimyceum, perimyceum, endomyceum, right? Okay, same concept for the nerve, except we're going to change the ending to neurium. This time it's epineurium, perineurium, and endoneurium. So I'll let you look at that picture. Hopefully that's just a big review for you. Notice those arrows labeling there. The outermost one on the top left is epineurium. The arrow drawn on the bottom left is perineurium. Notice it's wrapping a fascicle. And on the right, what are you wrapping? Endoneurium, and it's wrapping a neuron this time. Okay, and so on the right, you've got endoneurium, and that's wrapping a neuron. Bottom of your page, I just want to make a note here that tracts, nerves, and ganglia tell you something. When you hear the word tract, you're talking about a set of neurons in the central nervous system. You're going to talk about olfactory tracts, optic tracts. These types of tracts are neurons only in your central nervous system, brain or spinal cord. We just talked about ascending tracts and descending tracts. Those are collections of neurons in your central nervous system. So when I hear the word tracts, I automatically assume we're talking about brain or spinal cord. By contrast, when you hear the words nerves or ganglia, what nervous system do we reference? Peripheral, yeah, PNS. So we're talking cranial nerves or spinal nerves. You're going to hear things like optic nerves, olfactory nerves. You know, we just talked about dorsal root ganglion. Those are clues to where we're at. Nerves or ganglia tell us we're in the peripheral nervous system. Last little bit there for us on the top of page 107 today is ramus. Ramus means branch. Okay, so let's get a kind of perspective here. We're looking at the spinal cord's length, and you'll notice we've got dorsal and ventral roots coming out for these spinal nerves. And where they join, of course, is what we call a spinal nerve. Now, when we think big picture, these spinal nerves are then in turn going to branch. They're going to branch into an anterior portion, and they're going to branch into a posterior portion. These rami are going to branch and travel around your body to the front side or to the back side. So if this is my posterior side and this is my anterior side, then each one of those is going to serve as a branch that travels to the front or the back side. Let me give this to you in perspective. If you're thinking about the nerves that serve the muscles around your body, if you're talking about latissimus dorsi, would a posterior ramus or an anterior ramus serve that latissimus dorsi? Posterior, yeah. If the branch travels around the front and serves pectoralis major, it's now a
anterior,
yeah. So each spinal nerve branches as soon as it emerges from the spinal cord, and these branches are called rami. They are going to branch into an anterior portion and a posterior portion. Now, if you actually map these rami, you can find what's called a dermatome, and that means the piece of skin served by a spinal nerve ramus. And so this guy is color-coded. You'll notice the greens, blues, the orange or red here, all of that is color-coded based on which branch of a spinal nerve is serving that area. And so derma means skin, right? Okay, and this dermatome map tells us what portion of the skin is served by what spinal nerve branch. You're looking at the front of the body, those would all be what rami? Anterior. If you're looking at the back side of the body, those are all posterior branches or rami. The reason I mention this is because of viruses. Viruses love to travel along a particular branch or a ramus. The shingles virus, you know, which is the same as the chickenpox virus, varicella, loves to travel and inflame spinal nerves. So you can see one particular spinal nerve inflamed here. You can see another portion. The inflammation always starts at the spinal cord and then works toward the front side. Here's herpes. It does the same thing. It starts at your spinal cord and it works toward the front side as well. There is an old saying that goes, if the inflammation ever wraps you, it will kill you. But it's never going to come across the midline because you're basically being given a bear hug from behind by your rami. They wrap you from the back and they touch along your midline. Same thing with your cranial nerves on your face. So they're never going to jump across your midline and start that way. It has to start from the back and work its way across to the front. So, yeah, some interesting stuff there. I wanted to leave you with this parting thought today. That is a cranial nerve on one side inflamed, so one part of the tongue is inflamed and the other half is not. Yeah. Yeah. So I'll pick you up on Monday with page 108, and I'll bring you a clean spinal cord cross-section to practice labeling on.